From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Don't Knock the Rock. Singer-songwriter and guitarist Marshall Crenshaw has edited a new guide to rock and roll movies, featuring capsule reviews of such films as Jailhouse Rock, The Girl Can't Help It, and La Bamba, in which Crenshaw played Buddy Holly. Crenshaw will bring his guitar and play some good and bad music that came out of rock and roll movies. Also, we meet the songwriter who co-wrote such soul classics as Do Right Woman, I'm Your Puppet, and Dark End of the Street. And we hear him sing. Songwriter Dan Penn has made his first commercial recording as a singer. World music critic Milo Miles reviews the debut album by a singer from Zaire. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the third installment of Prime Suspect, which airs tonight. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. South African President F.W. de Klerk has extended voting for another day in some South African regions. Several areas have been unable to accommodate all voters. African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela had urged election officials to extend the voting because he says there's been massive sabotage. He didn't explain, but an ANC spokesman says Mandela was referring to ballots that never got to polling stations and other situations that made it impossible for South Africans to vote. The army worked through the night printing millions of extra ballots. Air Force planes rushed them to polling stations. The U.S. government says the economy grew at an annual rate of 2.6% in the first 3 months of this year. That's slower than some experts had predicted. But President Clinton was pleased with the report. He told members of the National Council on Aging that the gross domestic product report was good.
We meet at a time when the country is showing persistent signs of economic improvement. We just got this morning the information on growth for the first quarter, or the first 3 months of this year, it was 2.6%. That's a moderate level of growth. But that follows 7% growth in the last 3 months of last year, and that is in spite of a very bitter winter.
General Motors says it made $854 million in first quarter profits. The report is better than what analysts had expected. Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
GM's first quarter performance comes at a time when the entire domestic automobile industry is on the rebound. The nation's number one automaker says market share is improving and demand for new cars and trucks continues to be strong. Still, GM continues to struggle financially in its core North American car and truck operations. Despite improving sales, the automaker lost $27 million in that category. GM says it hopes it will be profitable in North America by the end of the year. Company officials also admitted today that GM's productivity is still not at world-class levels. The real strength of GM's balance sheet is in the company's European operations and in its non-automotive subsidiaries. Ford reports its first quarter earnings tomorrow. Last week, Chrysler said it earned nearly $1 billion for the period. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Confessed spy Aldrich Ames has pleaded guilty to espionage and tax evasion charges. He's been sentenced to life in prison. Ames' wife, Rosario, has pleaded guilty to related but lesser espionage charges. Her sentencing has been delayed until late August. Prosecutors say Ames, a CIA veteran, passed large numbers of secrets to the Soviet Union and later Russia in exchange for more than $2 million. Ames told a packed courtroom today that he has betrayed a serious trust. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 27 points at 36.71. This is NPR. New Japanese Prime Minister Tsutomu Hata has formed the country's first minority government in nearly 40 years. He's trying to reassure people about his chances of staying in power. Hata is popular with voters, but observers say his cabinet is doomed. The socialists abandoned the coalition government after receiving a snub. Hata failed to mend that breach. He says he won't call an early general election and he won't dissolve parliament. He wants to pass the budget for the next fiscal year, which is 4 weeks late, but elections could be called any time after that. Russian President Boris Yeltsin and a wide variety of political leaders have signed an accord meant to call a halt to the use of violence to settle Russia's conflicts. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
Yeltsin Yeltsin has been working on this civic accord for several months. In fact, it is the only political initiative he has pursued since reformist forces were humiliated at the polls last December. The pact is non-binding, but its main thrust commits its signatories to forego violence in the resolution of their disagreements. "We are united in our belief," Yeltsin told those gathered today at the signing ceremony in the Kremlin, "that no goal can justify the price of blood of human life." Among those who have signed the pact are the leaders of both houses of the Russian parliament, most of the nation's regional governors, and leaders of a majority of the parliamentary factions, including ultra-nationalist Vladimir Zhirinovsky. Conspicuously absent from the ceremony were those who led last October's uprising against Yeltsin, in particular former Vice President Alexander Rutskoy, who said he would welcome the support of all those who did not wish to sign. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
A spokesman for the U.S. Navy says an American pilot was killed today when his fighter jet crashed on takeoff from an aircraft carrier in the Adriatic Sea. The spokesman, who was aboard the carrier Saratoga, says the pilot's body has been recovered from the water and is aboard the vessel. The carrier is in the Adriatic Sea as part of the NATO effort to patrol the no-fly zone in Bosnia. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before the days of rock videos, rock and roll movies offered rare glimpses of the bands teenagers loved. There's a new guide to old and new rock and roll films called Hollywood Rock. The editor is singer-songwriter and guitarist Marshall Crenshaw. He's a longtime favorite of many critics, including our rock critic Ken Tucker. Ken described Crenshaw's album Life's Too Short as the most blissfully pure pop rock album in ages. Hollywood Rock features capsule reviews of classic films like the 1956 Rock, 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 and rock schlock like the 1957 Bop Girl Goes Calypso. We invited Marshall Crenshaw to bring his guitar and sing some of the good and bad songs that came out of rock and roll movies. Marshall Crenshaw, welcome to Fresh Air. Why don't we start with Elvis films? There have been some really great and some really cheesy.
Yeah, what were some
Elvis
great ones?
Elvis films.
Sorry.
Well, Jailhouse Rock, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely.
And Flaming Star I like a lot, even
Flaming
though he doesn't
Star
really
is
sing
cool.
In
yeah,
it.
That's
yeah.
right. Uh-huh.
And Flaming Star, he has real charisma in. You could tell that he had real potential as just as an actor, just as a physical presence.
I thought
on
he was really, I thought it was a really good movie. It was made by a really good director, for starters, a guy named Don Siegel.
So what do you think are the best and the worst of the Elvis films?
I don't know. Some of the worst ones are the ones I enjoy the most, I guess. Like, I really love Change of Habit, which is just an inexplicable, really bad movie.
It's Elvis and the Nuns.
It's the one, yeah. It's the one where he plays a doctor at a free clinic in the ghetto, and Barbara McNair and Mary Tyler Moore are nuns. Now, who's the third nun? Boy, there's a trivia question.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Anyway, well, I haven't seen them all. I guess I really like Loving You and Jailhouse Rock. You know, of course, the pre-Army ones are my favorites. Jailhouse Rock is a movie that you can get fashion tips from, I think. It's like, this is how to dress, you know? Dress like this. You know, the clothes in the movie are really cool.
So, Marshall Crenshaw, you've brought your guitar.
Yeah.
Would you do your version of one of the best or worst, or best and worst, songs from Elvis films?
Oh, okay, sure. This is a little snatch of a song written by someone I used to know, a man by the name of Doc Pomus. Really great, great guy. Viva Las Vegas. It goes like this. Ooh. Bright light city, gonna set my soul, gonna set my soul on fire. Got a whole lot of money that's ready to burn, so get those stakes up a higher. Well, there's a thousand pretty women waiting out there. They're all living the devil may care, and I'm just a devil with love to spare. So viva Las Vegas, viva Las Vegas, viva, viva Las Vegas. I went for the big note, and what happened?
Boy, you know, that's one of the real, like, you know, kind of...
Viva! Viva! Sorry.
Viva Las Vegas is one of the real, like, non-rock and roll type of songs, real commercial, but it really is catchy, isn't it?
I like it a lot. You know, the Dead Kennedys did a really funny version of it.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, really kind of, I guess sort of, like, you know... really found some potential in the song that nobody else really found.
Now, one of the movies that you write the capsule of in Hollywood Rock is Bye Bye Birdie, which you like a lot, which I was, of course, really surprised to read. Because
mm-hmm.
that's a kind of like ersatz rock and roll movie. It's
yeah.
you know, it's a kind of like the ersatz Elvis who's going off to the army.
Yeah, it's true. And it's also obviously written by people who hate rock and roll.
Right, by Broadway composers who really don't know much about rock and roll.
Yeah. But I really like the movie. I think part of the reason has to do with the fact that I saw it when I was a child. You know, I was like 9, 10 years old.
The character that's based on Elvis and Bye Bye Birdie is named Conrad Birdie.
Yeah.
And his big, you know, Elvis kind of number is called Sincere. Do you ever perform that?
Honestly Sincere, yeah. This is another thing. I used to play this at CBGB's back in the 80s, and people flipped, you know. I think people, you know, because it's like I was like making a TV reference because the movie's on TV all the time.
Uh-huh.
So people like TV references, I guess.
Can you do a little bit of it for us?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. Oh, yeah. You gotta be sincere. And then the girls scream.
Ah!
You gotta be sincere. You gotta feel it here. Because if you feel it here, then it's gonna be. What a. If. What you feel is true, you really feel it, you make them feel it too. Write this down now, you gotta be sincere, honestly sincere. I mean, you gotta be sincere. If you're really sincere, if you're really sincere, if you feel it in here, then it's gotta be right. It's not much of
a, yeah. Oh, that's my cue, right?
Yeah, you did good. It's not much of a song, is it?
No, but it must have been really really fun to do.
Yeah. Well, that's the scene in the movie where all the girls faint and then the mayor's wife faints. It's funny. It's
yeah.
funny to me.
But you know, Marshall, I was really surprised because it's considered such a girls' film.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, yeah.
See, I never knew that.
Well, I guess it's lucky you didn't. Might have changed your perception of it. One of your favorite rock and roll movies mm-hmm. is called The Girl Can't Help It. Why is that one of your favorites?
Well, it's for me, it's just something that absolutely works and is really basically perfect. It's loaded with really great rock and roll, like Gene Vincent and the Blue Caps and Little Richard and a lot of major studio 50s rock and roll movies have this really sort of condescending feel about them, you know, and they're loaded with a lot of preachy sermonizing about, you know, whether rock and roll is immoral or not, you know, all this ridiculous stuff. And The Girl Can't Help It doesn't have any of that stuff. It just kind of presents the artists, and then along with it, you get this really cool humor, you know. I just think that's a really good rock and roll movie, especially for a 50s major studio rock and roll movie.
Well, you've brought with you some music and some film excerpts of Hollywood rock and roll movies,
mm-hmm.
and maybe we can run through some of those excerpts and see what you've brought.
That's a good idea.
My guest is singer-songwriter, guitarist Marshall Crenshaw, and he wrote and edited a new book called Hollywood Rock, A Guide to Rock and Roll in the Movies. What are we going to start with?
Well, this first thing is a song by a group called Freddie Bell and the Bellboys. And, you know, these guys never had any hit records or anything, but they're kind of famous because they appear in Rock Around the Clock, which is the first rock and roll exploitation picture. And this is a thing called We're Gonna Teach You to Rock.
Hello, everybody. I mean, everybody. We're gonna teach you to rock. Yeah, we're gonna teach you to rock. We're gonna teach you to rock. Yes, come on and rock with us. We're gonna teach you to rock. Yeah, we're gonna teach you to rock. Yeah, we're gonna teach you to rock. Yeah, come on and rock with us. If you can't swing it out of the way, we don't want no squares.
All right.
Yeah, I feel like any sentence I say after a song like that should include the word daddy-o.
Yeah, I know. I can't place those guys' accents, but they seem to have a kind of a R problem, you know? Like the way they say, rock, 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 or I'll blow your brains out. You know, I like those guys, and they're really like a quintessential movie rock band because, you know,
I mean, like I said before, they never had any hit records, and they probably would have been just sort of forgotten, except they managed to wind up in this movie. So, you know, you get to see them on TV every now and then.
The next movie we're going to hear an excerpt from Marshall Crenshaw's collection, is Rock, Rock, Rock. This is an Alan Freed movie, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah, Alan Freed. This, I think, is the last of the three Alan Freed movies. And I guess if you want to see an Alan Freed movie, I'd recommend this one because it's got the best music in it. And but it's also got a couple I describe this as a treat for lovers of the truly inane. This is a song by a young girl called Ivy Shulman. She's 4 years old, and I have a 78 of this, and I've actually used this record to drive people from my home. You know, if it was getting late and I wanted to go to bed, you know, I play this record and it clears people right out.
Well, let's see what it does to our listenership.
I'm so glad we're going to play this on the radio.
Hi, baby.
Hello.
Were you waiting long?
Just a few minutes.
Ready to go?
I am, but this one.
Don't you want to go to the movie?
No.
You want a little doll?
No.
Don't you want a storybook?
No.
You want black?
No.
Well, then what do you want?
I know what she wants.
Don't want a dolly, a storybook of black. Baby's only happy. Oh, and she rocks. Baby wants to rock. Baby wants to roll. Baby wants to jump.
Well, bless my soul.
Baby wants to dance. Dance from head to toe. Baby wants to rock.
Then go, go, go.
I'm surprised you have any friends left if you play that a lot.
I know. It's pure torture, isn't it?
Well, Marshall Crenshaw, I don't think we can continue this interview about rock and roll movies without talking about your role in rock and roll movies.
Uh-huh.
In the film La Bamba, the Ritchie Valens story.
Yeah.
You played Buddy Holly.
That's right, I did. Uh-huh.
So, what did you do to become Buddy Holly?
What did I do? Well, they gave me a Stratocaster. I had my own Stratocaster, but I had to use theirs. They gave me some big glasses, which they let me keep. And then they put me in a little suit. You know, I don't know what did I do to become Buddy Holly. I didn't really. I just kind of, you know, sort of did it as myself.
So what song did you do in the film?
One called "Crying, Waiting, Hoping." And I discovered when I saw the movie that I didn't realize that I had really small hands, but I guess I do. You know, I kind of was like looking at myself up there, kind of going, oh, God, I have such small hands. Anyway.
Would you play a few bars of it for us?
Yeah. Crying, waiting, hoping you come back. I just can't seem to get you off my mind. Crying, waiting, hoping you'll come back. You're the one I love, and I think about you all the time. Crying, do-do-do. My tears keep falling all night long. Waiting, do do do. It seems so useless, I know it's wrong to keep crying. Waiting, hoping that you'll come back. Maybe someday soon things will change and you'll be mine. Crying, waiting, hoping, yeah.
That sounds great.
Why, thank you. You know, the funny thing about that, the usage of that song in the movie is that, you know, I think when Buddy Holly died, he had never recorded that song, you know, and really wasn't very likely to have played it on stage. But
so why did you do it?
Well, when I went to the session to do, you know, some Buddy Holly songs, and you know, we were just trying to come up with an arrangement for it in the studio, and to me, it was just kind of a throwaway. I didn't think that they would pick that one, because we also did "That'll Be the Day," and we did "Well, All Right." You know, I figured that they picked "That'll Be the Day." In fact, in the script, it said that the song was going to be "That'll Be the Day." You know, So we did this version of Crying, Waiting, Hoping with kind of like pounding tom-toms in the beginning and, you know, sort of a more of a 80s kind of a groove to it. And sure enough, that was the one that the filmmakers liked.
Marshall, can you recommend a couple of your favorite rock and roll movies that are on video for our listeners who might want to rent some stuff?
Yeah, I'll do that. You know, and I want to stress again that, you know, a lot of our book is just opinion, and you can sort of take that for whatever it's worth. But in my opinion, you can hardly go wrong with Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. That's really a lot of fun. I like the music. It's just really this wacky comedy that is better seen than described by me. Check it out. I also like this one called Wild Guitar from 1962, and it stars this fellow by the name of Arch Hall Jr., and it also stars his father, Arch Hall Sr., although Arch Sr. appears under the alias William Waters. But the cool thing about those two is that, you know, I think Arch Hall Sr. kind of pushed Arch Hall Jr. into show business, you know? And in the movie, the father plays the son's manager, you know? So there's this kind of funny tension between them. And also, Arch Hall Jr. has really nice hair, too. He has this, like, massive block of blonde hair. So anyway, check that out. And then my other favorite that I always mention is the Tammy Show, which is a concert film from 1964. Just a really straight-ahead concert film, you know, and this is from a time before rock and roll was self-conscious in any way. You know, it's just really kind of really great music. You know, the Rolling Stones are in it just before they broke big. James Brown is in it. Most people have seen that clip of James Brown where he, you know, falls on his knees and has the capes and everything like that. Marvin Gaye is in the movie. The Barbarians with their one-handed drummer, Multi. So yeah, my three favorites are The Tammy Show, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, and Wild Guitar.
Well, Marshall Crenshaw, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much for hosting me. It's nice to be here.
And thanks for playing for us. I really enjoyed your singing and playing. Thanks a lot.
Great.
Marshall Crenshaw edited the new book, Hollywood Rock, A Guide to Rock and Roll in the Movies. We have some new music from Zaire after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Zonga, oh, zonga, zonga, ah, zonga, 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 yeah, zonga, oh, zonga, zonga, ah.
World music critic Milo Miles is charmed by the debut album from Lokua Kanza, who is from Zaire and now lives in Paris. The record's primarily vocal and doesn't quite fit into any tradition, but then Milo says beauty is its own reward.
World music albums centered on voices seem to be a growth industry. The Bulgarian Women's Choir, Ladysmith Black Mambazo, and Zap Mama are all solid sellers. And there's no more certain proof of mainstream acceptance than making commercials for lifesavers like Ladysmith did. So it's no surprise that the self-titled debut album, Lokua Kanza, is both rich in a cappella vocal harmonies and that it had become very, very popular in Europe by the end of 1993. Mambo mingi mtota mama Mapendo njo mwiso Enyi mungu alituomba di Busiku inafika Tota mami na pashulale Dunia ni maneno Tota Lokua Kanza has played guitar and directed choirs for Manu Dibango and Ray Lima, two fusion experts who tend to throw all sorts of music into their mix. Out on his own, however, Kanza's kept things very spare. About three voices, a few guitars, light percussion, flute and bird whistles, and not much else. While very exposed, the sound is quite subtle and beholden to few obvious sources, aside from gospel choirs and a bit of pygmy chanting. As a choir arranger, Kanza has found his own way past many overly used paths. Whether giving off a yelp or a croon, Kanza's pitch is always clean, though never antiseptic, and he shows a fine ear for mixing the cadences of French, Lingala, and bits of English. All that's missing from the Lokua Kanza album is more sense of what he's singing about. No translations or song descriptions are included. Titles like Passion, Never Lose Your Soul, and Land of Love are self-explanatory, even though Land of Love is mostly an instrumental. And he tells us in English how he was jilted in the song Just un peu d'amour. Still, being a bit contradictory and mysterious is part of Kanza's charm. When love is in short supply, as he points out in his liner note, sometime we are in search of a knowing smile or just a fanatic glance from a stranger. The gorgeous glances from Lokua Kanza are not to be missed.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. He reviewed the debut album of Lokua Kanza on the French import label Night and Day. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Ilenjia ulichagua inapashwa ukwe akili watu wote wanatafuta Fika yulu na eshima Pole pole ile njoni mwendo Upenda mali tutakosa mapendo Pasi yote we Never lose your soul Never yeah. Pasi yote we Never lose your soul Never Basi yote ni giza Tuko natafuta ukweli Watu mingi wanafika sawa nyama Usifate ile njia Pole pole ile njoni mwendo Kupenda mali tutakosa mapendo Basi yote we Never lose your soul, never. Come mi savo moi na yote. Never lose your soul, never. Tali payo kokende. Never lose your soul, never, never. Yo, pasio te we. Never lose your soul.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, songwriter Dan Penn tells us some stories about last-minute inspiration that resulted in such soul classics as Do Right Woman and Cry Like a Baby. Aretha Franklin, Percy Sledge, Otis Redding, and others recorded Penn's songs. Now he sings them on his new CD. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the third installment of Prime Suspect, starring Helen Mirren. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The new Japanese prime minister has formed a minority government. Tsutomu Hata has failed to get the socialists to return to his government coalition. Their departure leaves Hata's government at least 50 seats short of a parliamentary majority. The BBC's David Powers reports.
Mr. Hata was clearly under no illusions about his problems as the head of the country's first minority government since 1955. I expect, he said, extreme difficulties. But even though the socialists had caused so much trouble to his predecessor, Mr. Hata said he'd not given up on them. The socialists, he said, had worked hard with the previous cabinet to bring about political reform, and he appealed to them to cooperate on policy matters. He said the tasks now were to reform the tax system and to get rid of unnecessary bureaucracy and regulations. Asked about the prospect of a trade war with the United States, Mr. Hata said the real problem was Japan's overall trade surplus with the rest of the world, not just America, and he specifically mentioned the European Union. The new prime minister will in fact be visiting Europe next week, but he said he has no plans to go to America at the moment.
David Powers reporting. Italian media magnate Silvio Berlusconi has gotten approval from the Italian president to try to form a government. It would be the first conservative Italian government in Italy's post-World War II history. Berlusconi's likely coalition government partners are two political rightist groups, the anti-bureaucratic Northern League and the National Alliance. That group has fascist roots. Berlusconi's own party, called Let's Go Italy, was created only months before the Italian elections. Delta Airlines says it will cut up to 20% of its workforce. The Atlanta-based carrier says the cuts will come over the next 3 years. Ed Hula reports from Atlanta.
The job cuts were announced as Delta released its first quarter earnings that showed an $80 million loss. Delta, the nation's third biggest airline, plans to eliminate 15,000 jobs through 1997 as it reorganizes its workforce. Delta estimates it could save $2 billion a year with the changes. The move is Delta's latest attempt to escape red ink. It's racked up $1 billion in losses through the 1990s, despite past reductions in employees as well as pay cuts. Ronald Allen, the chairman of Delta, says the new job cuts are needed to help the airline compete more effectively against low-fare airlines. For National Public Radio, I'm Ed Hula in Atlanta.
The government says orders to U.S. factories for durable goods rose a modest 0.4% in March. That's a sharp rebound from the weather-related decline in February. The Commerce Department says the increase is the seventh in the last 8 months. Stock prices were off sharply today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials fell nearly 31.25 points to close at 3,668. Declines led advances in heavy trading. This is NPR. Confessed spy Aldrich Ames will spend the rest of his life in prison. Ames has pleaded guilty to espionage and tax evasion charges. He's the highest-ranking CIA worker ever caught spying. He's admitted selling secrets to Moscow since 1985. Ames' wife Rosario has also pleaded guilty, but to lesser charges. Her sentencing has been delayed until August. The Federal Trade Commission has levied its largest fine ever against a firm that made unsubstantiated advertising claims. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
The federal government cracked down on General Nutrition Incorporated, part of the nation's largest retailer of nutritional supplements, GNC. GNC's nearly 1,600 stores specialize in vitamins, diet pills, and bodybuilding formulas. The company will pay $2.4 million and must provide evidence for items it sells. It also must stop claiming its anti-baldness products work. The company was ordered in 1970 and again in 1989 to substantiate claims for over 40 products. These include such things as dynamic fat burners, which sell for $18 for 130 pills, and bodybuilding amino acids called Right Stuff. GNC executives say they complied with the FTC orders. They say their stores only sell but don't make most of the offending products and say GNC agreed to pay the fine to avoid expensive litigation. In Washington, I'm Christopher Joyce.
United Nations officials say heavy fighting has broken out in Rwanda. UN officials in Kigali, the Rwandan capital, say they're ducking mortar fire as they try to deliver relief supplies to the needy in the city. Four plane loads of relief supplies are at the Kigali airport, but renewed fighting is making it impossible for the goods to be delivered. Relief agencies estimate that 100,000 people have been slaughtered since the fighting began in early April. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Take me to heart, and I'll always love you. And nobody can make me do wrong.
That's Aretha Franklin with one of the classic soul songs of the 60s. My guest Dan Penn co-wrote that and several other classics like I'm Your Puppet, Dark End of the Street, and Cry Like a Baby. Penn was one of the key behind-the-scenes figures in 60s soul music as a songwriter and sometimes session guitarist in Muscle Shoals, Alabama and Memphis, Tennessee. Otis Redding, Percy Sledge, Solomon Burke, and Arthur Alexander are among the singers who did his songs. Now he sings them himself on his new CD, Do Right Man.
Yeah, yeah. They say that it's a man's world. But honey, you can't prove that by me. And as long as we're together, baby, show some respect for me. If you wanna do right, home days, woman, you gotta be a do right, home man.
Dan Penn co-wrote that with Chips Moman. They gave Aretha Franklin Do Right Woman when producer Jerry Wexler of Atlantic Records took her to record in Muscle Shoals, Alabama.
Jerry loved it. Aretha heard it. She liked it. But they both said, it doesn't have a bridge. It needs a bridge. And I agreed. So we headed for the closet, three of us, while the band was learning it. And we wrote the bridge, Aretha, Jerry, and I. They say that it's a man's world. All of that.
Now, the way the story, as I've read it, goes about the session in which Aretha recorded your song, Do Right Woman, was that it was a disaster at first.
It wasn't a disaster at first. It was a disaster later, but at first it was a wonderful session because they cut I Never Loved a Man, and it came off, well, you know, you heard it came off great.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a wonderful session. Everybody was joyful, and it was great. And then later, when everybody got to drinking a little too much, not me. Not that time. So I was just watching all the haps go down. And there were a few incidents that happened at the studio and then later on at the hotel. I didn't even go to the hotel, so I didn't see the main fight, but I understood about it. But, you know, by the time the second song they cut, they only cut two songs, Never Loved a Man and Do Right Woman. And I mean, she didn't have time to learn the song. So I had to do the song. I had to do the palate vocal in her key with only a spinner on the organ and a little guitar chink and a drum and a bass hitting every once in a while. It sounded awful when they left Alabama with it. And I had no hopes that that it would ever sound good at all. But later on, Chips and I came to New York, and we were at Atlantic Records, and Wexler, Jerry, said, come back here with me, boys, I want to play you something. He took us back to the Atlantic studio, and he played Aretha's. She had gone in and played piano and sang so great, and her sisters. And it was a great moment in our lives, and probably one of the highest places I ever heard, you know, ever felt for me. It was so wonderful.
When you record demos for a performer who's going to do one of your songs, do you try to sing in their style?
No, at one time I might have, but anymore I just try to sing the song some kind of honest way, that the way I feel it. I try to be neutral, kind of. Actually, I try to undersing just a little bit.
Why?
Don't obscure them, you know.
Oh, so that they could feel, well, that's okay, but I'll show you how it really should be done.
Well, now, you know, if it's a black singer, I would do the best I could, because they can always do better. But a lot of white singers, you have to kind of underplay it, because, excuse me, a lot of them can't really sing as good as maybe they could, you know. I mean, you scare them. You hit some notes or some little trills that maybe only you can do at that time, and they love it, and they try to do it, and it don't come off, and then, you know, there goes your song down the drain.
Mm-hmm.
So I give them a neutral, hey, here's a song, do your own thing. I try not to interpret.
Now, you grew up in Vernon, Alabama, which is about 80 miles south of Muscle Shoals. Alabama was very segregated when you were growing up. So what was it like for you when you started working with black artists and becoming part of black culture? Was it all very different to you? Were you ever uncomfortable around black culture? Or did you feel very comfortable right from the start?
I felt comfortable right from the start, and I stayed comfortable right up until, until it was over.
Until what was over? Soul music?
Yeah. You know, I think when they killed Martin Luther King, it was over.
What changed for you when Martin Luther King was killed?
Well, what changed for me was, the black folks didn't want to make records with white people anymore. And so, since I was white, that kind of cut me out. And when we found that out, you know, we basically didn't want to do business either, so it was a bad time.
Were there people who you had been very close with musically who you weren't able to work with anymore?
No, it wasn't like that. It was just like, it was like an invisible line. A curtain was drawn across the color line as far as recording. I mean, it's something you felt, it's something you knew.
In the days before the King assassination, were you ever self-conscious about being a white songwriter in soul music?
Well, you knew you were, but I wasn't alone. I mean, there's Cropper and, you know, all these other cats, Chips and Spooner and you name it. I mean, you know, they were Carole King. I mean, they were all around. But, no, it wasn't a self-conscious thing. It was like, hey, this is wonderful. But it wasn't like I'm not supposed to be here. It was like, oh, how lucky I am.
Right.
And it was fun.
Songwriter Dan Penn is my guest. He sings his own songs on his new CD, Do Right Man. More after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
back with songwriter Dan Penn. Let me play another one of the songs that you wrote that you do on your new album, and this is Dark End of the Street, that was recorded by James Carr.
Right.
And do you remember the year?
Oh, I'm going to take a shot at 67 or 8.
Okay. No, this is a cheating song. A couple who has to kind of meet in private because they shouldn't be lovers. Did you have someone in mind when you wrote this, or was this just part of the cheating genre?
Well, every songwriter that's ever picked up a pencil has always wanted to write a really, really good cheating song.
Right.
Whether it's country or blues or... I mean, that's the... it don't get no better than that. If you do that well, you know, you feel really good.
Why don't we hear your version from your new album of your song, Dark End of the Street?
Yeah.
At the dark end of the street, that's where we always meet, hiding in shadow where we don't belong, living in darkness hide our wrong, you and me, at the dark end of the street, you and me.
That's Dan Penn from his new album, which features him singing some of his best-known songs that other people have recorded over the years. You worked at studios in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and in Memphis. Was there a difference in the sound at both of those studios?
Yes, it was different. Subtle differences. I always say that it's the air. But I guess it's everything that's there, you know. I mean, I worked in Muscle Shoals at Fame. It had this really great basic sound. And then when I got to Memphis, I could tell a considerably different sound. It was a more exciting sound. I don't know how to say except, you know, it's a river sound. And Memphis is a lower level in altitude. So I always kind of think about altitudes for sounds. Memphis was lower, it was muddier, it was funkier, and it was even more fun. Nashville is higher up, and it's more clean, more pristine, you know, more managed, less fun. Muscle Shoals is right in the middle. It has some of the funky grubby about Memphis in it, but it also has some Nashville cleanness about it. So, you know, any of them sounds good, but Muscle Shoals was the place I chose when I decided to cut the record.
When you were working in Memphis, you produced the Box Tops record. You produced, I guess, The Letter and also Cry Like a Baby?
Yep.
And did you write those songs too?
I didn't write The Letter.
Uh-huh.
Spooner and I wrote Cry Like a Baby.
Uh-huh.
I'll give you a short deal about that if you'd like.
Yeah.
It's 4 o'clock in the morning, Sunday night, I believe, and we were in Porky's Barbecue right across the street from American Studios, and we were having our last meal before calling it a night, and we were dejected and felt really bad. We were just sitting there weak and hurt, and I knew I had this recording session coming up at 10 o'clock that morning, and this was going to be a test for my production qualities. I didn't have any songs. And we're sitting there, and old Spooner just puts his head over on his arm, and he said, "I could just cry like a baby." I said, "What did you say, Spooner?" He said, "I could cry like a baby." And it went all over me, and I said, "Spooner, that's it." He looked at me, and I said, "Let's go." So we got up from our meal, and I tossed the guy some money. The time we got across the street, we already had. When I think about the good love you gave me, I cry like a baby. So suddenly we just got healed, you know, from our missed sleep and from our discomfort of not having done anything good. Suddenly we were 100%, just like we'd had 8 hours sleep. So by now I guess it's 5 in the morning, so we waited for the band. They came in. Of course, Alex came in. He had never heard the song. He learned it right away, and the band loved it. And so we sold 1 million records again. And I've never had to worry about whether I was a record producer anymore.
It's a great story. What you do and don't miss about the old days?
What I do and don't?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I really miss the Black-White Association.
Mm-hmm.
I do. I mean, don't get me wrong, I think there's some blacks and whites working together somewhere, but they're not working together in model areas. And I miss that. I mean, I always got a lot out of that. But that's one thing. One thing I don't miss. I don't miss. Seems like the egos have quietened down some now. So I don't miss that. I include my own. And a lot of the noise we used to have on the tape, I don't miss that.
Right. Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
All right. Thank you.
Dan Penn's new album is Do Right Man. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel, host of All Things Considered. Coming up later on today's program, we'll hear about the voting in South Africa, where the first all-race election has been extended by one day. Also, Ted Clark reports on some South African history, in particular the history of the struggle to end the system of racial apartheid. Also today, we'll be hearing about the guilty pleas of Aldrich Ames and his wife. Ames was the CIA employee who today accepted a life sentence. His wife will get far less than that. The CIA announced in court that Ames's spying for Russia and the Soviet Union before that had resulted in the deaths of many agents around the world. Those stories coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Tonight on PBS, the anthology series Mystery presents the third installment of Prime Suspect, a miniseries starring Helen Mirren as a British detective. TV critic David Bianculli says it's one of TV's most worthy recent offerings.
As TV detectives go, Helen Mirren as Detective Chief Inspector Jane Tennyson is the best thing to come along since Peter Falk in Columbo. The Tennyson character was created by author Linda LaPlante, who wrote the first Prime Suspect miniseries and suggested a storyline for the second. Now, for Prime Suspect 3, she's written the entire script again, and it's terrific. Let Diana Rigg, the host of Mystery, set the stage.
In her years on the force, Tennyson has seen corruption take many forms, among her subordinate officers as well as her superiors. It has always disgusted her, so much so that she's now requested a transfer to another station. But instead of a homicide posting, the job she does best, she's assigned to the Vice Squad in Soho, a district where vice is just another word for business as usual.
What makes Prime Suspect 3 so wonderful is that it's almost impossible to second guess. That goes for the murder mystery, and it also goes for Detective Tennyson's relationships at work. There's sexism at play and professional jealousy. And because this case involves alleged abuses at the highest levels of the police department, there are also spies on her staff reporting back to her superiors. She knows they're out there, but she doesn't know who they are, and neither do we. That doesn't stop her from doing her job, which is to investigate the death of a young male prostitute. Along the way, the suspects keep changing, and so do Tennyson's allies on the Vice Squad. The best news about Prime Suspect 3 is that the acting, from top to bottom, is every bit as strong as the script. And Mirren, at the center of it all, couldn't be better. Even when she's taking part in the most common confrontation on any police show, the determined cop being scolded by superior officers, Mirren's passion and strength make it seem real.
Chief Inspector Tennyson, you give me no option but to warn you that if you continue to investigate persons...
No, not persons. Just one person.
Against specific instructions, then disciplinary action will be taken.
Take it, sir. And I will fight you every inch of the way. I have been fobbed off with stay clear of this or that person's because of, and I quote, repercussions to this department. Well, this department has blatantly attempted to sabotage my investigations into a murder which has direct links to a paedophile ring, one member of which, John Kennington, was a subject of a full-scale internal police inquiry.
John Kennington was reinstated.
Yes, 6 months later he's being blackmailed. Case dismissed. What happened? You'll get cold feet, retire him, pay him off, and somewhere in the mess a young boy dies.
Just calm down.
I was impressed by Helen Mirren's work way back when she starred in the movie Oh Lucky Man, and thought she was remarkable in The Cook, The Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover. But Prime Suspect is her biggest career achievement ever, and it's a franchise that should continue for a long, long time. Prime Suspect 3 has the best interrogation scenes since Homicide: Life on the Street, and even better police station characters and intrigue than NYPD Blue. If you like mysteries and quality television, don't miss it. On the other hand, run, don't walk, from this Saturday's NBC telemovie, Tanya and Nancy, The Inside Story. It's awful. It's also tacky, irresponsible, cynical, poorly constructed, and, let me get just the right word, repugnant. The one part I could identify with is when Heather Langenkamp, as Nancy Kerrigan, gets whacked in the knee and screams, "Why me?" While watching this terrible docudrama, I was screaming the same thing. For putting on trash like this, NBC should change its mascot from a peacock to a vulture.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, and Bob Balls. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, one of our most requested recent interviews, an inside look at hate groups from former white supremacist Floyd Cochran. He used to be national spokesman and recruiter for the Aryan Nation. Now he's speaking out against the racist ideology he used to promote. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.